From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, it's the first day of Comedy Week. Through the week, we'll feature interviews with some of America's funniest writers and performers. Today, old-timers. We begin with the king of the one-liners, Henny Youngman. Then Alan Zweibel looks back on his early career when he was writing one-liners for some of the old-time comics in the Borscht Belt. Phyllis Diller tells us what it was like to be one of the only female headliners of her generation. Then the thin and glamorous Joan Rivers tells us why she established her comic identity with jokes about being fat and ugly. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The tobacco industry has agreed to pay the state of Florida a reported $11.3 billion. The agreement settles a lawsuit filed by Florida to recover public costs for treating sick smokers. Jury selection in the trial is underway, but a spokesman for Florida Governor Lawton Chiles says it became clear last week a settlement was possible.
The tobacco CEOs began admitting for the first time that cigarettes are addictive, that they cause cancer, and that they had marketed to children. That was part of the settlement negotiations that took place beginning last week, and we saw the good faith effort that the CEOs were making, and that spurred the negotiations forward.
Governor Chiles is expected to make a statement shortly. Dow Corning is offering to settle claims over breast implants and other silicone devices for nearly $2.5 billion. The company announced the offer today as part of a reorganization plan to end all claims in its federal bankruptcy case. The company president says the deal offers settlement options for women who claim Dow Corning's implants harmed them. Women who choose to take the plan have four options, including compensation to have the implants removed. Taiwan's ruling National Party opened its 15th Party Congress today with a call to end years of hostility with China. NPR's Mary Kay Magstead reports from Beijing.
Despite China's suspicions that Taiwan is seeking independence as a separate nation, Taiwanese President Lee Teng-hui today reiterated his party's position that Taiwan should eventually reunite with the mainland, but only once China's economic and democratic evolution has caught up with Taiwan's. Meanwhile, Lee's vice president, Lian Chen, said today that Taiwan and China should stop being so hostile to each other and should instead consider an exchange of visits by their respective leaders. This proposal has been raised before, and Beijing's response has been that it's happy to receive Lee Teng-hui as the governor of a Chinese province, but not as the president of Taiwan. Beijing sees Taiwan as a renegade province and has of late increased pressure on Taiwan to return to the motherland. Mary Kay Magstead, NPR News, Beijing.
An Israeli news report says Russian scientists are reportedly helping Iran develop missiles that could strike Israel. Israel's Channel 2 reports hundreds of Russian scientists are working on the missile project. The Russian government denies giving missile technology to Iran, but a spokesman for the Russian Foreign Ministry would not comment on the report. U.S. news reports have said there are signs that Russia has indeed transferred such technology to Iran for the Russian SS-4 missile. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up more than 34 points at 7,922. The Nasdaq is up 11.5 points at 1610. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the stock market is higher following a mixed opening. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports from New York.
The Dow's advance is being led by Philip Morris. Tobacco stocks are higher following news that the state of Florida has reached an $11 billion settlement with the tobacco industry to recover money paid to treat smokers. Analysts say the agreement makes it easier for the industry to win congressional approval of the $368 billion national settlement. The stock market is also being boosted by a list of mergers. The day's biggest creates the nation's largest drug and medical supplies distributor. Cardinal Health is buying Bergen Brunswick for $2.8 billion. At the same time, the New York investment firm Hicks Muse Tate is buying SFX Broadcasting for $2.1 billion. I'm Doug Krisner.
United Parcel Service has made its final contract offer to its pilots. The company's offering pay raises and better pension plans. The president of the Independent Pilots Association says he'll present the offer, but hasn't said whether the pilots should accept it. The pilots observed the picket line set up by Teamsters during the 15-day strike against UPS. The Teamsters say if the pilots decide to strike, Teamsters will observe the pickets. Burger King is telling customers there's no need to worry about its hamburgers. Advertisements are appearing in papers across the country today saying the restaurant chain no longer does business with Hudson Foods. That beef supplier recalled 25 million pounds of beef last week because of possible E. coli contamination. The nation's second largest fast food chain restaurant suffered because of that recall. One of every four Burger Kings in the United States could only serve chicken, ham, and fish for at least one day. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, putting a world of knowledge within your reach, with over 170 locations across America. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we begin Fresh Air Comedy Week to help you face the end of summer with a good laugh. We begin Comedy Week with one of the great old-timers.
The king of the one-liners, Kenny Youngman.
If I had blood, I'd blush. Downtown, I said to a lady, you know where Michigan Avenue is? She says, yeah. And she walked away. One fellow said, give me $10 till payday. I said, when is payday? He said, you ought to know. You're the one that's working. One fellow said, I haven't eaten in 2 days. I said, you should force yourself. One fellow said, I haven't tasted food all week. I said, don't worry, it tastes the same.
Kenny Youngman has done it all. Vaudeville, speakeasies, the Borscht Belt, the Ed Sullivan Show, nightclubs, casinos, and sometimes even bar mitzvahs. He's never tried to keep up with the times, and there's been plenty of periods when younger people thought him hopelessly square. But he's been Kenny Youngman for so long, he's hip. I spoke with him in 1991 when he was 85. I started with the question you've got to ask Kenny Youngman. How did he come up with his most famous one-liner, "Take my wife, please"?
I was on the Kate Smith Show at the time, and my wife came in a half hour before the show. Henny, I need 8 tickets for the show. Luckily, the ushers saved some tickets for me every week. I used to give them $2. That's all I had left. So I got the tickets for Sadie, and I said, take my wife, please. Like, get her out of here. I want her in the audience. And that stuck all these years.
Do you still have jokes in your repertoire that go back to your days in vaudeville?
Sure, I do the same jokes now. I need a new audience. That's all I need. Yeah, I'm always adding.
What are some of the ones that go back to the bar?
I take my wife everywhere, but she finds a way home. I said, where do you want to go for your anniversary? She said, I want to go somewhere I've never been before. I said, try the kitchen.
Now, how did you start doing jokes that basically insult women?
Well, I tell you, they're cute. They're not insults. They're cute, but we have to bounce off somebody, you know. You have to make fun of my brother-in-law. You know how he gets rid of his garbage? He gift-wrapped it, leaves it in the car, they steal it. How long are you going to wait to laugh, Terry?
Oh, I had to think that
one
through
first. Yeah, I know it. I got to explain the jokes to you.
Now, there was a time when you were performing at speakeasies for a lot of gangsters in the audience.
Oh, yeah, that was Alito, Venice, and Patterson. My boss used to stab me good night. The check room girl's name was Rocco.
So in that routine, you used to do a lot of insult humor.
Yeah, I did. I always insulted the gangsters. They liked it.
What kinds of jokes?
If you had your life to live over again, don't do it.
Why did gangsters like insult humor so much?
Well, if they like it, they'll take anything from you. If not, you get your head broken somewhere, you know. I heard them plan kidnappings. I kept my mouth shut. I minded my own business. But they let me sit with them all the time. They liked me, luckily.
Did you like them?
Yeah, they weren't bad fellas. Although they were murderers and thieves. But around a table, they were nice, you know.
Now, early on in your career, you say you stole jokes. Who'd you steal them
from? I didn't steal them. I took them. I didn't have to steal. They're public domain.
How often have jokes been stolen from you over the years?
Oh, thousands. I put 30 guys in business. When I was on the Kate Smith Show, I had 7 writers. So every week I told 26 jokes that went out in the air. And a lot of comics started from those routines. They couldn't afford writers. They were all amateurs at the time. Buddy Hackett, Jan Murray, Red Buttons, all these guys started in business with my jokes.
What's your most stolen joke?
Take my wife, please. You hear that all over the country.
But everybody knows that's yours.
Yeah.
So
I think I'm associated with it by now.
But what about a joke that's been stolen that people don't realize is
yours?
Well,
I do all the wife jokes and the brother-in-law jokes. They take them every day. A hooker walked up to me. She said, I'll do anything you want for $50. I said, paint my house. That's around the country now. I brought that around, you know.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Henny Youngman.
King of the one-liners.
Yes.
Mention that. That's another thing. Walter Winchell gave me that line.
Yeah, and tell the story of that.
Well, Walter Winchell, I used to sit with him every night. I was starting out, I hung out at Lindy's. I got to know all these columnists, Jack O'Brien, Walter Winchell, Leonard Lyons. And these are the people that used to make you famous. They would put you in their column constantly if they liked you, attached to a joke. And that's how you built a reputation those days. And Walter Winchell gave me a title, King of the One-Liners, and that stuck. So now I got Take My Wife, Please, King of the One-Liners, and Henny, Where's Your Fiddle? I play fiddle.
Now, I'm going to ask you to tell the story of how Ed Sullivan banished you from the show for 5 years.
I had spent $5,000 on new jokes that weekend. I had money to spend. I really wanted to be good, you know. One of those things, you hit the whole network, you want to be good. But I spent $5,000 and gathered a lot of jokes. So I knew them pretty well. I hadn't done them before, but I got them ready to do them that Sunday. He calls me upstairs, take this joke out, take this out, take this out, take this out. I got on stage. I didn't know what I was doing. I really was a mess. He broke up my rhythm. He broke up my routine that I had learned. I came off and I called him a dirty bee. I said, you amateur night son of a bitch. How dare you do this to me? 5 years I was off there.
You write in your book about how you still work the phones all the time. And it sounds like, you know, if you're at the Carnegie Deli, the phone rings for you. In the barber's chair, you're calling.
Wherever
about
it is,
days.
I let people know where I'm at.
Yeah, now,
in case you need me for a job, you know where to get me. My service knows where I am at. I let word when I came at the studio here that I'm here to get my phone calls.
Have you gotten any calls yet?
I don't know. I'm talking to you.
Let's ask Leszek, the engineer. Leszek, has he gotten any phones yet?
Just one.
He's got one phone call already?
Yes.
Who's it from?
It was a gentleman who didn't introduce himself.
Oh, okay. Well, who knows what that's going to be,
yeah,
right?
I get calls all day.
Now, here's what I don't know. Don't you have an agent or something?
Sure, I have the William Morris Agency.
So what do you have to get the phone calls
because
for?
Because I like to do... Many years ago, I used to call agents to get jobs when I wasn't known. I had to let people know I'm in business. I do sales meetings. I do trade shows. I do conventions. I do outdoor fairs. I do commercials. So I had built up a business before I went with the William Morris office. I let people know where I am, how they can get me. They tell me how much they want to pay me. They send a half a deposit, and I do the job.
Now, you know, I've heard that you have a listed number in the New York directory. So just,
sure, I don't owe any money.
Yeah, so just to test it out, I called New York Information earlier today, and I said to the operator, operator, I'd like the number for Henny Youngman in Manhattan, and the operator said, the Henny Youngman? And I said, yes, and the operator said he would not have a listed number. I said, no, but I think he does, and sure enough.
That's astounding, you know, because people think you haven't got a number. That's no good. I want them to know I have a number so they can get to me.
But don't the people who really need to get to you for business reasons know
yes.
how to reach you?
Sure, now they do. You're letting them know.
Now, if I call that up, would I just get an answering machine or would you
no,
pick
you
it
get
up?
My service.
Oh, I see. Oh, no wonder you could give it out so liberally.
I don't care. As long as I don't owe any money.
Are you doing any topical jokes in
Very
your show
seldom.
Now?
No, not mm-hmm. too many.
You have a great Imelda Marcos one in the book.
Yeah, well, I did it, but she's in Israel planting a shoe tree.
Yeah, I really love that.
Yeah. Well, that was topical. It's still good sometimes. But I try to get jokes on a topic at once. Now, I'm just saying, now, Liz Taylor's been married 8 times. She has rice marks on her face. I did that about Zsa Gabor. But now that she's doing it, I use it on her.
Now, do you do all your own jokes now, or do you have writers who are doing them?
No, I have no. I haven't got a steady job. I don't need writers. I got 2 hours of material in my head. I go out on the stage, I do 40 minutes, 45 minutes.
You're still telling Take My Wife jokes?
All the time.
How do they go over now?
Fine.
Yeah, still in the age of the women's movement?
Sure, my wife and I are always holding hands. If I leave, go, she shops.
How did your wife when...
My wife was a pretty woman. She didn't mind what I said about her. She ran after the garbage man. Am I too late for the garbage? She said, no, jump in. My wife didn't know I worked at these gangster places. She would have been frightened. She didn't mind it at all. She didn't know what I was doing. I had conflicts with my wife all the time because my wife was a day person. She wanted me to have a job 9 to 5. I got lucky, and I got in another business which she knew nothing about, and my family resented it. Her family resented it. They thought I was a bum because I hung out in Lindy's till 4 in the morning. They never heard of Lindy's. So I had that to contend with all my life until my wife finally accepted me coming home late at night.
So the marriage withstood both your jokes and your wife's lack of understanding of show business.
Sure. Well, I wouldn't leave my family. I wouldn't leave them. And she wouldn't leave me. Where would she go? She had 2 kids, you know. So we had a lot of fights and arguments over these things. Making people understand what you're doing is very tough,
mm-hmm.
especially when in my business.
What about your parents? Did they ever understand?
No. How would they understand? I was playing people. If I didn't take them to New York, I don't think they would have gone. They lived in Brooklyn.
No, you got thrown out of high school, right?
I was asked to leave, yeah.
What for?
Telling jokes or breaking up the class. Teacher thought I was a nuisance. He could have laughed, but he was an idiot, I guess.
So when you were thrown out of high school, what did you do next?
My father made me learn a trade, printing. I went to Brooklyn Vocational Trade School.
So how did you go from, you know,
I don't know.
Trade school and all this
I had
to
a band.
Show business?
My father made me study fiddle.
Mm-hmm.
My mother.
Well, they wanted
My aunt gave me a fiddle. Her son didn't want it.
They wanted you to be a great classical violinist.
Right, sure. I studied 7 years. And we had a comedy band like Spike Jones. And one night, an act didn't show up, so the boy said, Henny, you know a lot of jokes. You got to save my life. I got a banquet out there. I went on. I told all my jokes. I did a half hour. I was a riot, really. I had a lot of funny stuff. He said, let the band go, will you? I'll keep you. So I became a comedian.
And when you were getting started and you were trying to, you know, convince people to hire you, where would you go?
Well, I went around all the agents in New York. There were booking agents.
Uh-huh.
There were buildings that had booking agent on the door. So I'd walk in and introduce myself. Some of them used me, found out it was funny, and... That was it. I got around. I got jobs here and there. Got jobs with the fiddle. I got jobs telling jokes.
Would you have to do shtick for the booking agents in their office?
Well, I used to come in. I usually come in with a joke of the day. I used to find a joke and tell it to them. They laughed at me, and they got to like me, you know. You got to prove you're a comedian. You can say it, but you got to prove it.
You know, a lot of interviewers like to ask the tombstone question, what would you like written on your tombstone? I myself never asked this question, but to you, I'm just curious if you want a one-liner on yours.
Well, I really never figured that out, honestly. When I lost my wife, I used to say, take my wife, please. That's the one time I didn't want to say it.
Yeah.
I'll have to figure that out, what to say on there. Leave them laughing. Ha, ha, ha.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, thank you. When you come to New York, call me. Take my number.
Please.
Please. I'll take you to the Friars for lunch.
Oh, boy, I'd really love that.
Yeah, you might enjoy it. Hey, Terry, thanks for your time.
Thank you so much, and
it's
I wish
a pleasure,
you the best.
Really.
Henny Youngman recorded in 1991 when he was 85. When we called him last week for an update, he told us he was still performing. Coming up, a comedy writer who got his start writing for older, often washed-up comics in the Borscht Belt. This is Fresh Air.
lot of comics who rejected the old style of one-liners in favor of more personal material actually got started in the business by writing one-liners for older comics. Alan Zweibel started his comedy career writing jokes for comics who played the Borscht Belt, the resort hotels in New York's Catskill Mountains. Zweibel went on to write for Saturday Night Live and co-created and wrote It's Gary Shandling Show. On Saturday Night Live, he collaborated with Gilda Radner, co-creating some of the characters she became famous for, like Emily Latella and Roseanne Rosanna Dana. He later wrote a book and play about Radner called Bunny Bunny. Here's an excerpt from our 1989 interview. Now, you used to write for comics. You wrote for Borscht Belt comics, the comics who played the Catskills?
I started that way. I started writing for men like Morty Gunty and mm-hmm. Freddie Roman and Dick Capri and Dick Lord and Vic Arnell, and it goes on and on and on. Thousands of Bernies, thousands of Mickeys, hundreds of Lees. And ultimately, I started off writing for $7 a joke. And this was right out of college, which was 1972. And to supplement this terrific living that I was making, I was also working in a delicatessen in Queens. And you name it, I sliced it for about 3 years. And what I used to do was sell jokes to these comedians and write down jokes on paper bags and then shove them in my pocket and sell it to them.
What was the first joke that you sold?
You know something? One of the first jokes that I had ever written and no one paid me for was one of the first jokes that we did years later on Saturday Night Live, which was about a stamp, the post office coming out with a stamp commemorating prostitution in the United States. It was an 8-cent stamp. If you want to lick it, it's a quarter. And are you allowed to say that on this radio show? We did it on Saturday night. I mean, that just goes to show you how long ago that joke was written, because I don't believe they have 8-cent stamps anymore. And it was those kinds of lines that... that the people I was writing for said, they're funny, but it's not for my audience. You know, these were by and large blue-haired ladies who went to resorts on the weekends and on you know, major holidays.
So did you have to write mother-in-law jokes, honeymoon night jokes?
Oh, God, yeah. Don't touch me. I just had my hair done jokes, sending the kids to camp jokes, you know, all the cliche kind of jokes. And it was incredibly frustrating. In its own way, it was like, well, it was great in a way. In one way, it was like writing for your father, you know. But what was very, very interesting about it, and which was a great training ground, is what your ear got accustomed to was the way different people spoke. All right? See, what I used to do as a matter of self-discipline was I'd wake up on a Monday morning and I'd say, okay, this week we're going to talk about cars, right? So on Monday, I would write a monologue as if Woody Allen were to deliver it about buying a car. Tuesday, I would do it as if I'd write a monologue for Joan Rivers about buying a car. Wednesday, Rodney Dangerfield. Every single day, I take the same topic and try to put it in the mouths of other people just as a way of training myself.
Did you ever have to write jokes with Yiddish punchlines?
Oh, you know, it's really amazing in that I used to write for a lot of the Friars' roasts, you know, where they used to roast somebody once or twice a year. And those, are, by and large, are stag. And what you can do is you can get laughs if you just say a couple of words and then throw in a dirty word. You know, the shock value would get a laugh. And the same thing for a lot of these comedians. If I would just say, you know, yesterday I bought a new chair, Rosh Hashanah, and they'd start laughing, the audience. I mean, just totally out of context. You know what I mean? If you just put in, like, the name of a Jewish holiday or a recipe, they would laugh.
What's an example of a way a comic really ruined one of your jokes?
Oh, that's a tough question. Okay. This isn't the perfect answer to it, but I think it sort of answers a question. Years and years later, after I had stopped writing for these stand-up comedians, I was now married. And we went up to the Concord Hotel for like a ski weekend. And we went with Al Franken, who used to be a co-writer with me on Saturday Night Live, he and his family. And we were up at the Concord, and we went in to see the show. And on the bill was a man who I used to write for. And I'm sitting there, and I recognized much of the material. Now, let's say this was 1986. I hadn't written for this man since 1973. Okay, so let's see, this is 13 years have gone by, and I'm recognizing the jokes as by and large the same. We went backstage afterwards to see him, or I met him in the bar afterwards, and we said hi to each other, and we got to talking, and he said, "How do you like the show?" And I said, "Terrific, really good." And he said, "You see, I'm still doing your stuff. It's still holding up." I said, "Yeah, I'm flattered." He said, "Any suggestions?" I said, "Well, one minor suggestion. You know that joke that you do about the Secretary of State?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "So I could be wrong, but as far as I'm concerned, you might get a better laugh if you took out Kissinger's name and put in George Shultz's."
And you're kidding.
No, this was 1986, and I had written in 1973 when Kissinger was, and he'd never bothered taking out the old guy's name, and so he was doing it still in the present.
I find this incredibly depressing. I mean, are you depressed by that?
On one level, it's somewhat depressing. On another level, you're dealing with, in a few instances, with people who are sort of blissful and unaffected. And there's something nice about that, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not trying to wax romantic about it. But if somebody could be off by that much, do you know what I'm saying? I'm not trying to be cruel. It's
right.
Like, God, my guess is that they sleep better than I do.
Alan Zweibel recorded in 1989. His book and play, Bunny Bunny, is about his relationship with Gilda Radner, who he collaborated with on Saturday Night Live. Well, more comics in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. And here's Mickey Katz's parody of Sweet and Gentle, as performed by Don Byron and his band.
She's so sweet and gentle.
She's so sweet and gentle.
Oh, it's sentimental.
Oh, it's sentimental.
No one can deny it.
No one can deny it.
Like gold is on the fire. Wenn sie von ganzem Machen, hol ihr mit dem Cha-Cha.
Cha-Cha-Cha-Cha.
The boy is polishing her back. She schläfts mir on the floor just like a toy to catch
Like a Katschke?
Machen mir ein neues Zweck. She's not so gentle when she holds a fendel.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, as Comedy Week continues, two women who paved the way for women comics, Phyllis Diller and Joan Rivers.
Beautiful day for the race. Stoogetown is the favorite today. Assault is in there. Dog Biscuit is 3-1. Safety pin has been scratched. And at 20-1, Beetle Bomb. Now the horses are approaching the starting gate, and there they go!
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We continue Comedy Week with Phyllis Diller, one of the first and only women comic headliners of her generation. Her persona as a crazed housewife, her jokes about her husband Fang, and her many rounds of plastic surgery didn't exactly set the stage for the feminist revolution, but she paved the way for other women comics. Here's a performance from 1961.
And here's what happens. A woman hits 40. Going 90 miles an hour. And boy, that's a crack up. One morning, she gets up, she looks in the mirror, she punches the panic button. She says, I gotta be younger by lunch! And she'll go through a whole list of idiotic ideas like renting smaller children. But 9 out of 10 will rush off to a plastic surgeon. Or go under the knife, as we say at the clinic. And are you ready for the big fallacy? They all expect to come out looking like Tinkerbell. So what if you do? What are you going to do about the rest of it? Gravity's been pulling on it for 40 years. And I hate that word gravity. It reminds me of a little personal tragedy. 2 weeks ago, my Playtex living bra died. Of starvation.
Phyllis Diller got a late start in show business. She was a 37-year-old mother of three when she started to perform. In 1986, I asked her how she'd come out on stage in her persona as a crazed housewife.
Describe the way you will typically come out for a performance.
Like a maniac, dressed silly, with silly hair, funny little boots, little gloves. All clowns wear gloves. Even Mickey Mouse. And I wear gloves, the little teeny short gloves, and a little short dress, and that's it. It's a funny persona. And this woman is an idiot, you know. She's a harridan. She comes out, she's telling everybody what's wrong with everything, you know. Please.
So you designed your own image. You designed your own clothes, too. Did you decide what to wear on stage?
Well, you see, I used to dress pretty square, pretty straight. The first few years, I wore actual... One year, I wore Chanel suits. Another year, I wore a Balmain suit. And they were satin and shiny. And I realized I had to wear something shapeless or I couldn't make jokes about my body.
Because your body was too nice?
That's right. I hate to tell you that. So then I invented shapelessness, and to this day I wear shapeless things so that I can tell them anything I want about my body.
What was your self-image like then? Because you'd get on stage and talk about how ugly you were and how, you know, your husband wouldn't come near you and all these jokes about that. And in fact, you probably had a terrific figure. You're probably, you know, a good-looking woman, but you'd made yourself into a crazy woman for the performance. So what was your self-image like deep down inside?
I was so busy carving out a career that I didn't have much of a problem with it. I mean, I wasn't a beauty. I was never a beauty. A beauty is sort of a way of life. A beauty is sort of the way you act. Beauties are soft and they talk a certain way. Beauties don't talk like I talk. You know, I'm into the nitty-gritty. I'm into editing. See, my mother, when the phone rang, she picked it up and said, "State your business." So you see, I was not brought up to be a beauty.
In your routines, you do pretty rapid fire.
Well, 12 laughs a minute is as fast as anyone can talk.
How do you build it up? Is there a model that you have about how jokes should build and when the capper should come on?
Oh yes, the final word must be the joke word, must be the operative word. The final word should end in an explosive consonant, like pop, or puck or kook. You understand? There are mellifluous words. Mellifluous is one of them. It flows. It's pretty, you know. It's one of those lovely words like lavender. You want something strong and pop at the end, like a shot. For years and years and years, people likened my delivery to machine gun fire.
Is there a rule of thumb you use about how many you can tell in a row like that before changing the subject?
Yes.
A sense of rhythm about that?
You find that out by doing them. You have a whole... You want to do as many as you can on one subject because, you see, it's economy. You have one setup, and then all the tag, 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 you don't have to repeat the setup. Because every time you do a tag, it has to have a setup. But if you can have one setup and then as many as possible lines, but there is a limit to how many they will take on one character.
Can you give an example of the setup and a few tags?
Well, she's so fat that. That's your setup. And then you've got all these tags, like sa-da-ba-da-dum, ba-da-da-doom, di-doom-doom-doom-doom. It's music.
You always strike me as being the forerunner of, say, Joan Rivers, you know, that like one of Joan Rivers' models for a few reasons. First of all, because you're two of the few women who've made it to your stature in the world of comedy, but also because of your self-deprecating kind of humor, which she really has gotten into. Do you see any connection? Do you know her well?
Yes, she's my dear friend, and I don't know any other way for a female comic to get on. You have to beef about something, because comedy is tragedy revisited. That's my definition of comedy. People say, what is comedy? Okay, if you come out and you're lovely and there's no comedy. So self-deprecation and denigration is par for the course. Works.
Do you think it's different for women than for men? Do you think that women more so have to have that kind of humor?
They need a little more help than men do, because there's a double standard. Men can talk raunchy without being pilloried. Women are it's the Madonna complex, the Madonna syndrome. They're the mothers, the softies. And when a woman is going to be hard enough and aggressive enough to do comedy, she better have some saving graces. Like, look, I'm humble. I don't think I'm pretty.
Did you have to do that? I mean, do you feel like you had to do that to get in or something?
No. Uh-huh. Remember, I didn't know anything about what I was doing.
Right, okay.
Look, if I hear a laugh, it stays in. It's very simple. Like, if the bucket doesn't leak, don't repair it.
You recently had plastic surgery, well, several times.
All the time.
All the time? what have you had?
Oh, have you got an hour? I've had everything. I've had 3 facelifts. The latest thing, I had that eyeliner put on, permanent tattoo. I had a chemical peel. I had a breast reduction. I had a tummy tuck. There's only one procedure I haven't had, and that's liposuction surgery or lipectomy, where they use a vacuum thing that was invented in Paris to suck out unwanted fat from places on your body where exercise doesn't affect.
Why did you have all the plastic surgery?
I was ugly and beginning to look old.
Mm-hmm. Well,
old and wrinkled and hangy.
Uh-huh.
We're talking droop. Droop city.
It's interesting because you'd made your career on being crazy looking, on putting yourself down, on being the frumpy housewife.
True.
So now, I mean, you look rather glamorous.
I hope so. But you see, I'm a single woman and I have a private life. My private life is very important to me. Very important. That's my real life. My life on stage is not real. I am a person. I am real. And I want to look good.
If you had the perfect nose and lips and breasts and everything when you were getting started, do you think you would have gone into comedy?
Well, I did have the perfect breasts, the perfect figure, and my nose was crooked. Let me think. My teeth were crooked. Well, comedy is within. It has nothing to do with your appearance. My appearance helped because it was dysplastic. It helped. And then I made it help more by getting crazier and learning to be theatrical and things like that.
So you have 2 personas, as you always did, one offstage and one onstage. And how are you dressing onstage now?
Crazy. But chic. I mean, it's a satire of what is chic right now. That's the way I dress.
Are you still talking about Fang?
Oh, honey, he's so big in my act. He's one of my big numbers.
Did you like wife jokes when how do you feel about them now?
I think they're wonderful. I love jokes. I love comedy. I worked with male comics who said, you've heard this is a classic because more than one comic I've heard say it, is where he's married to the woman who's so neat, She's always, everything has to be perfect. And men don't like that. The joke that I loved, when he got up to go to the toilet one night, came back, the bed was made. Have you heard that joke?
No.
Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah.
Can't you see this compulsive woman? Yeah, making this man's life miserable.
The problem I've always had with wife jokes is that they always seem to be about the whole genre of women. It's because they were never spouse jokes, because until you came along, there were no women telling jokes. So the joke was always on the woman and never on the man. So instead of being jokes about married life or having this lifelong companion, it was always jokes about women, jokes about dames. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, it seemed to put down the whole gender instead of... you know, talking about the tribulations of a long-lasting relationship that men or women would have. Do you know
True.
What I'm saying?
I know what you're saying. But I did some good work, didn't I?
Yes.
I almost have a cause.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's been such fun, Terry. I really love your show.
Thanks. Thanks for being here.
Phyllis Diller recorded in 1986. Coming up, another comic who paved the way for other women comics, Joan Rivers. This is Fresh Air. Fresh Air Comedy Week continues with Joan Rivers. Like many comics of the 50s and 60s, she reached a national audience through The Ed Sullivan Show.
From upstairs to the downstairs, our daffy little friend, Joan Rivers.
I almost didn't come out tonight because I'm backstage shortening my skirt. And every time I shorten my skirt, you know, you have to shorten it again because of the dumb styles. I don't know if you're aware of it, but do you know that skirts are going up, which is great if you're tall and thin. But if you're short and squat like me, you can just forget it, you know that. They're going up, do you know they're going up now 10 inches above the knee? Did you read that? 10 inches above the knee? What if you're short? What if you don't have 10 inches? What are you supposed to do? I'll tell you something, the way the styles are today, I'm glad I'm married, because if I was single, I could never get married looking like this, you know? And I feel sorry for any single girl today. The styles and the whole society is not for single girls, you know that. Single men, yes. A man, he's single, he's so lucky. A boy on a date, all he has to be is clean and able to pick up the check, he's a winner, you know that. Or a man can call up anybody in the whole world, you know that? Hello, I saw your name in the locker room, I thought I'd give you a quick call. A girl can't call. Girl, you have to wait for the phone to ring, right? And when you finally go on the date, the girl has to be well-dressed, the face has to look nice, the hair has to be in shape. The girl has to be the one that's bright and pretty, intelligent, a good sport. Howard Johnson's again, hooray, hooray. Excuse me. A girl, you're 30 years old, you're not married, you're an old maid. A man, he's 90 years old, he's not married, he's a catch. It's a whole different thing. Isn't that so? Yes, yes. It kills me. We have an extra man. Bring him along. He's 98. Bring him. He's dead. Bring him. We'll prop him. Just bring him.
Joan Rivers recorded in 1967. I spoke with Joan Rivers in 1991 after the publication of her autobiography, which covered everything from how she writes jokes to how she survived the most difficult period of her life. After her husband Edgar's suicide, Rivers was devastated. It took 5 months before she went back on stage. She told me what it was like that first night back on stage after Edgar's death, when she felt ready to be funny again, but the audience was still uncomfortable.
It was very difficult. They didn't know. I was hanging over the audience. It was hanging up. Her husband killed himself. She was fired from the Fox network. She's finished. She's over. She's not funny. I really think they came to look. And tremendous tension. And I was very nervous. And I figured you might as well go. It was the way I've handled my whole life. Go out and just talk about it from the beginning. And instead of waiting till the end to talk about it, I walked out and talked about it at the start and made them laugh. And that cleared the air. And I thought to myself, oh, thank you, God, I can continue as a comedian.
So what kinds of things did you say about Edgar or the suicide in your act?
Well, you have to deal with it. I mean, these people were not stupid. I said, my husband killed himself. as you all know, and he asked to be cremated and have his ashes sprinkled in Neiman Marcus, because then he knew I would visit him every day. And they laughed. And that was the only reference I made to it. And it was just fine. It was just enough.
Now, you say that your audience didn't want you to be sexual when you went back to comedy.
No.
What kinds of jokes weren't going over?
I'm not a sexual person, certainly on stage. And they loved hearing about my sex life when I was married. They didn't want to see a 52-year-old woman at that point talking about dating. And they just didn't want to hear. And there was one joke, which is so indicative. I had written this joke saying, I don't think I'm good in bed. I said to a man last night, why don't you call out my name while we're making love? And he said, I don't want to wake you up. And that got such a gasp from the audience. So I changed the joke to say, I don't think I was good in bed when I was married. I once said to my husband, why don't you call out my name while we're making love? And he said, I don't want to wake you up. And it got a big response. And I realized right then and there they didn't want to hear dating jokes or any kind of any innuendo about sex for me currently. Not that there was any, but, you know, you write these jokes. But you write these jokes, you know, you come up, well, I'll do a whole thing on going out with a man, he tries to make out with me, you know, something like that. Or I try to make out with him. And I realized they didn't want to hear that from me.
Now, so much of your material over the years has been about how you look, you know, about feeling unattractive, about being too heavy, about not being sexy. Yet for years, your onstage look has been positively glamorous. Yeah. You have gorgeous clothes. You're incredibly thin. You've gone through plastic surgery. You look terrific. So does it ever feel like the material is out of sync with who you really are, who you've really become?
No. Everybody tries to look. I don't know, one person listening out there gets up in the morning and says, I think I'm going to pick the ugliest outfit and I'm going to try to look really unattractive today. We all try to look the best we can, and I've just done the best I can with this package, you know? But I diet all the time, and I try to look good, and the wrinkles are coming on, and no, I don't look hot at all. I look good for what I started out as, but that's it. So it doesn't, and they look at me on stage, and they go, yeah, she's right, she is a pig. There's no question about that.
So your self-image is still in keeping with the kinds of jokes you tell about
yourself? Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Do you still tell jokes about being heavy?
I get on a scale twice a day, and I am still heavy. I've seen myself in a bathing suit. This is not thin, you know, skinny mini over here. My thighs, a family of 18 could live on them for a year if you put ketchup on them.
I see. I think that's a very funny joke, but I look at you and I think, you know, you're seeing somebody different in the mirror than who you really are.
I hope so. I hope so. Because what I see in the mirror, boy, I don't like.
Well, why did being overweight and feeling, that you weren't attractive have such a profound effect on you?
Well, I think it has a profound effect on everybody. When they write in your yearbook, here comes fat, fat, the water rat, you don't forget that. That ruins your yearbook. You don't forget it when you come down the stairs at college and a blind date says out loud to the guy standing next to him, why didn't you tell me? These are things that scar you very, very deeply. And stay that way, you know, that's it.
How did you feel about the recent TV Guide cover story on celebrity plastic surgery? And the cover had a before and after picture of you on it.
I don't get plastic surgery. Celebrities will tell you they were raped by their mothers, they were beaten, incest. I mean, they will tell you the most. One comedian, you know, would say how her parents took excrement and put it all over her, you know? And you say to them, did you have a facelift? What, me? Never. I don't know. And everybody has done it. And I just think people should, see, tell the truth. What is so terrible to say, I want to look better, and I had my nose thinned. I want to look better, and yes, I mean, Jane Fonda, who was into exercise, as we all know, has had the facelift, has had the boobs done, has had God knows what, and that's fine. Why are we playing this game? I don't get it. So I was delighted to come out and say to my audience, I'm going in now because my eyes look like hell, and I'm getting a really bad under-the-chin look. Delighted to do it.
I'll tell you the problem I have with plastic surgery, and tell me what you think of it. I think that we're just creating this just impossible ideal. And I think of, like, the young Joan Rivers who was uncomfortable with how she looked. Imagine if she felt she had to live up to
the kind
of body and face that could only be created by surgeons.
Let me just tell you something, and it's very nice to say, and I'm already bored to death. Let me just tell you something. We're in a business where you have to look good.
Yeah.
Where they fire people because they're getting old. And it's very easy to say, let's grow old. The public doesn't want to see an old puss giving the news, and you know it, and talk to Jane Pauley at 40.
So you feel that you really have no choice.
There is no choice in our business. There is no choice. We didn't want to see Elizabeth Taylor jowly and horrible. We're thrilled to see her looking good again. We're thrilled to see Sophia Loren looking beautiful. I mean, who are we kidding?
My guest is Joan Rivers. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our 1991 interview with Joan Rivers. I was interested to read about the working method that you developed early on for writing your jokes. You said that you can't just sit down and write jokes.
Yeah.
You needed to, like, work off somebody. So you used to have Rodney Dangerfield come over.
Yes, we were all very young in those days.
So tell me how you would work together, what the process was like.
Process is just, I come out of Second City, which is all, you know, verbal. And we would sit and just start saying, okay, answering machine. Let's do jokes on answering machines. Well, okay, my answering machine, I'm so boring, my answering machine doesn't even pick up. No, that's not good enough. Okay, let's do an answering machine. Answering. All right, how about, I'm so boring, my answering machine put me on hold. Good. I mean, you just keep, the process is, you just bounce on one another. Do you find something you like?
So Rodney Dangerfield was somebody good to bounce off of.
Wonderful. He was wonderful. Another man named Marshall Brickman, who wrote all the early Woody Allen movies with Woody, who's now writing himself and directing himself. Marshall was a joy, because you would come in and sit and laugh till you found something good.
Have you ever had people writing for you?
Oh, of course. And anyone out there that thinks they're funny, please send me some jokes. I pay $10 for every joke that I use.
Gee, that's not a lot.
It is when I buy the joke and paper it before I've even tested it. I think out of 100...
Oh, you mean like if I sent you any lousy old thing, you'd pay
$10. They send me like a bunch of jokes. I'll say, oh, let me think, I'll try this one. I think I'll try 4. So I'll send them a check for $40. Then I take those 4 jokes and try them out. And if you're lucky, one joke out of 15 works. One joke out of 20 works. One joke out of 100 really works. It's very hard. Everyone sees different ideas of what is funny. And when I write jokes myself and they don't work, it's very hard for me because I think, but that's funny. Why aren't you laughing?
When you were subbing for Carson, did his writers write any of your opening monologues?
No, because his writers would, and they're right, and they were right, would give me the jokes they didn't want to give Johnny, which means Johnny got the good jokes. Johnny was paying them. If you write a brilliant joke, who are you going to give it to?
Right.
The guy that's paying you or the girl that comes in once a week who has nothing to do with your life or your future? So they didn't give me good jokes. So I would come in with my own.
Well, also, there's something so much, like from a woman's point of view about your jokes. I'm sure all of us writers, or certainly at least most of them, were men.
And again, the funniest jokes, of course, come from me.
Mm-hmm.
It truly ends up what I think is funny, my perception of something. Always is the strongest in my act.
When you started to perform, did you look up to the few women who were in the field, like Phyllis Diller, Toadie Field, Selma Diamond?
No. I never think in terms of comedy as male or female oriented. I looked at Lenny Bruce because he told the truth. Mm-hmm. He told the truth. And as a very impressionable young woman then right out of college, the first time I saw him, I went, but he's saying what I'm thinking. Maybe not with those words, because in those days you just didn't say the words that he said. But he's saying what I'm thinking, and that's what I want to say on stage.
What was your early material like before you'd really kind of developed the Joan Rivers persona?
Very shocking in those days. I played my first record, which really was my successful record for 1966, called Mr. Phyllis and Other Stories, which was about my hairdresser. And I played it for Melissa, and the record in those days was like, did you hear what this girl has on a record? I mean, you know, they didn't even know my name at that point. And my daughter and I said, isn't that sweet? In 1966, to say you were having an affair with a married man, and while he was engaged to me, his wife became pregnant, which is one of my jokes. So I don't think, my joke was, while he became engaged to me, his wife became pregnant, so I don't think he's sincere, was my joke. This shocked audiences. And my daughter and I said, isn't that cute? So what was shocking then is not shocking now. But I was always shocking within the framework of the time period.
When you started off, it was before you were married to Edgar. You'd been married once before. So did you have a guy in your life to do jokes about? You know, did you have like a name to use?
I had
a person.
I was having this affair with this college professor from Columbia, who indeed was married at the time, separated but nonetheless married. And so I used that, and I used all the jokes which were true about dating. And my mother was crazy. She had two of us that weren't moving, as the expression goes. And I talked about that a lot. And my sister graduated from Columbia Law School at 21, was very pretty and nothing. And my mother would just, no matter what happened, you know, and I talked about in the act, if you saw an accident, my mother would say, that means a wedding. You know, she was always looking for, a man would be decapitated, the head would roll to my mother's feet, my mother would go, this means a wedding, this means a good. So that's what I talk. I always talk from truth. You know, I think that's very important for your act, that they know, even though there's a joke there, that you really mean what you're saying.
Joan Rivers, recorded in 1991. Fresh Air's Comedy Week continues tomorrow. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Bob Purdick, Fred Snyder, and Al Banks. Alan, too, directed the show. And we say goodbye, good luck, and thanks for all the good work to our intern, Francis Yu. I'm Cherie Gross.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Comedy Week continues with the king of understatement, Stephen Wright. Also, interviews with Saturday Night Live alums Chris Rock, Al Franken, and John Lovitz. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.